please give a warm welcome to Julian Barnes. What made you want to write this particular book?
I came across the story in a book I was reading about the Dreyfus Affair, and the English historian, a wonderful man called Douglas Johnson, who wrote this short introduction to the Dreyfus case, said there was a case in Britain only 3 or 4 years afterwards which had many of the same elements. There was a miscarriage of justice. There was a sentence of hard labour. There was a racial element to the case. Dreyfus was Jewish. My George character, his surname is Adelgee. He was a Parsi. His father came from Bombay and then strangely became a minister of the Church of England. There was a key element of both people were convicted on handwriting evidence given by handwriting experts, which at that time was held to be, you know, of the highest scientific value. And in fact, one of the handwriting experts involved in the Dreyfus case was brought in by Conan Doyle into this case. And finally, there was, you know, a famous writer riding to the rescue. And this man, Douglas Johnson, who said, you know, well, why has this case been, this English case been completely forgotten, whereas the French case echoes down through subsequent French history? He said you might think that it's because the French case is about high treason, whereas the English case is about animal mutilation, as it is. He said, but that doesn't really work, because the English are probably more shocked by animal mutilation than they are by high treason. Which I thought at first, I laughed as you did. I'm very glad you did, because it shows we're all normal. At first I thought that's a very witty thing to say, but this man, Douglas Johnson, was not only witty but wise. And I sort of went on thinking about it, and I don't know if the name Anthony Blunt means anything in Switzerland. There's no reason why it should, but there was a famous spy ring in Britain from the 30s until the 50s, and they were one by one. There were four or five Oxford and Cambridge graduates who became communists and spied for the Russians. And one of the key figures in it was a man called Anthony Blunt, who pursued, you know, how spies are meant to melt into the background or you know, become indistinguishable from the society which they're betraying. Well, he became so indistinguishable from the society that he was betraying that he was a great expert on art, a great expert on Poussin. He was the great Poussin expert of his day. He taught at the Courtauld Institute. He taught Anita Bruckner, for example, my fellow novelist. And he was also the keeper of the Queen's pictures. So every day, or not every day, but on a regular basis, he would look after the pictures of Her Majesty the Queen, and then he would go off and tell what he knew to his masters in Moscow. And at a certain point, he was unveiled. It was clear that he was the fourth or the fifth, I can't remember which number he was, of this spy ring. And what do you think they did? This is England, after all. They said, well, this is very bad of you, what you've been doing, but carry on looking after the Queen's pictures. It's okay. You seem to be rather good at that, you know. And I thought, if this man had been convicted of, you know, taking a penknife to the Queen's little dogs, you know, then he would have been out on his ear. But high treason, okay, fine. High treason, it's all right.
Okay, but we should...
I'm sorry, that's way off the point by now.
Right. So you knew about this case, you started reading about it, and then
yes.
What?
I started reading about it, and I found there was very little to read about it. That was, you know, the short answer is I wrote the book in order to have something to read. Because there were newspaper accounts in the local press, there was Conan Doyle's own account, a summary of the case in the Daily Telegraph. And then it features in every Conan Doyle biography. It gets exactly the same page and a half to 2 pages with exactly the same summary and exactly the same conclusions. And I just wanted to know more. And the only way to know more was actually to invent more, because though Conan Doyle's life is too well known, George's life is, you know, he's a cipher. He barely exists except as a victim in this story, in this case. Initially I had thought maybe I should write a short non-fiction book about this, but it wouldn't have worked because it would have been full of those phrases which I find extremely irritating in history and biography, where it says, surely at this point George must have been feeling very depressed or something like that. And I'm a fiction writer, and so it's much easier for me to say, write a sentence which says, George was depressed. You know?
But
and more convincing as well.
What did you have to go on as far as George is concerned? For example, this whole business of his sleeping in the same room as his father and his father locking up the room every night. It's a very strange thing. Is that something you
invented? No, that's true. That was true. What I had to go on with George was the newspaper accounts, which were fairly inaccurate and fairly contradictory one to the other, a short character description by Conan Doyle, and oddly, a book that George wrote about railway law. He was a lawyer, and he was very interested in the laws governing travel on the railways. And he wrote a 120-130 page basic guide to railway law. And I found myself at one point reading this book, trying to deduce his character from it.
There's one thing you said. In the passages we heard, it was about Arthur being imaginative and George completely lacking imagination. So is that something you deduced from reading this particular book?
No, not really. In fact, what I deduced from this book was that though it was clear that George was a timid fellow. He had very bad eyesight. He didn't seem to socialize much. He never married. He never seemed to have any women friends. He lived very much within his family. He ended up living till 1953 with his sister. His sister registered his death. It seemed to me that when I was reading this account of railway law, that actually he seemed quite relaxed and almost funny in it. And so I imagined him as a character who, once he's behind his desk in the office, he can be his fullest self, as many people are. And then once he steps outside, the dangers of the world, the cow that explodes, you know, unexpectedly in the field, alarm him. In the same way I made their religious, they each have a religious trajectory to them, Arthur and George, and I made George's deliberately go in the opposite direction to Arthur's for novelistic reasons. But I have no knowledge of whether George's travails actually made him lose his faith or not. He just disappears from history, you see. I won't say exactly what happens to him, but after his troubles, he has another 45 years to live. And I researched him. I found out where he lived. I found out where he worked. But when he died, there wasn't an obituary anywhere. His case had been completely forgotten. I saw photographs of him, but there are only about 6 of them.
As we heard from the reading, it's always Arthur, then George, and you jump from one to the other. When you were writing this, did you do stay in character as method actors do, and did you do a lot of Arthur's first and then a lot of George's, or how did you do this?
Well, this is different from a book where I had the names of the characters at the start of each section called Talking It Over, which had a a sequel called Love, Etc., where each of the voices was first person. So they were telling you the story. Here, though it goes Arthur George, there is a third person narrator, i.e. me, in charge.
Yes, but we see the world through
their eyes. Yes, sure. But it's rather different from having to switch from one voice to another. You're switching from what's happening to them. And for a long time, their life doesn't overlap. So it's rather hard to answer your question exactly, because often the process of getting to the solution, which is the book, wipes out some of the problem solving that helps you get there. It's like a black box. If the plane doesn't crash that day, then its contents are erased. But looking back at the sort of first section from which I was reading, the first and the sort of 60 pages which go with those similar short sections, I think some of them were longer and some of them were shortened and some of them didn't immediately play off the one before and the one after, which is what I wanted. But in answer to your question, no, I didn't do all Arthur and then interleave him with all George, no.
Have you ever heard from any descendants of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle whether they have read the book and what they thought about it?
Well, I quickly realized that one of the advantages that I had writing this book was that George, as I said, never married. He had a sister, Maud, who never married. They had a brother, Horace, who completely disappeared. Apparently he changed his name, married and went off to Ireland, and no one knows what happened to him. So the George side of the story, no descendants at all. Arthur Conan Doyle had five children by two separate marriages, which is a bit threatening to a writer. But none of those five children had children. So it all goes out into cousins and second cousins and stuff like that. And I had an exchange with a Conan Doyle biographer, and he said, Conan Doyle estate is very peculiar. They almost never answer any approaches about whether you can have the right to do this or the right to do that or information about anything. And I wanted to know if there are any documents relating to the case. So he's this nice American biographer called Daniel Stashire. He said, I will alert them that you're going to email them. And so I will prepare your approach. So I sent this email to the estate saying, and I'm interested to know if the box of papers referred to in John Dixon Carr's autobiography of Conan Doyle, paper box 19C exists. Anyway, so, it's a long and official and serious application. I didn't even get an answer. And actually, I thought, good. If they can't be bothered, then they're not going to complain if I get anything, if I make things up. There is a character in the book. There are various policemen in the book, and it's clear from the newspaper accounts that the police did not behave well, and that a certain amount of evidence was definitely corrupted, and that a certain amount of racial prejudice was involved, and that from the very high level of the police, they were sort of out to get George. But there's a good policeman, or a goodish policeman, as good as policemen come. I hope there aren't. If there are any policemen in the audience, I immediately withdraw that remark. I didn't mean it. There's this intelligent, modern thinking policeman called Inspector Campbell. And at a certain point when I was doing my research, I went up to the Staffordshire Constabulary and I looked at their archives and I was shown photographs of Captain Anson, for example, who's the chief of police, and one or two others. But I didn't actually see a picture of Inspector Campbell. So I sort of thought, well, I've got to give him some basic physical description so that readers will be able to follow him from one place to another. So I decided for some reason that he had red hair and that he was very tall and was sort of long-backed and sort of camel-headed, I decided. You know, sometimes you care very much about what a character looks like, and sometimes you decide a character looks like something in order to make a contrast with other characters. So I fairly deliberately yet cavalierly made this guy look like that. Wrote the book, went to the Edinburgh Book Festival to launch it. Man came up to me afterwards and threw down his business card in front of me. And it said, had a name on it, and said, something, something science writer. And I thought, oh dear, I've obviously got something wrong, you know. But I can't remember which bit of science it is. Probably it's about the, you know, the Society for Psychical Research or something like that. It's the spiritualism side I got wrong. He said, I'm Inspector Campbell's grandson, he said. He did not have red hair. He was not long-backed. And he was not camel-headed. But I suppose he's your character now, he said, in a way that was not placable. In fact, it was roundly implacable. I didn't really know what to say. I mean, I said something like, he is actually the nicest of the policemen.
You mentioned before that George is a Parsi, so his father is Indian, his mother is Scottish. And what I found really interesting in the book is that he himself never thinks that it is for racial reasons that he's being persecuted. Is this something which was the case, or is that something you invented?
No, I think this is, I didn't invent this. This is one of the most interesting aspects of a case, I think. After his ordeal, he wrote a series of newspaper articles. And at one point he said specifically that he did not believe that the racial element was at the basis of the case. And he said it as bluntly as that. And I thought, this is very interesting, because it seems utterly clear to me, as it did to Arthur Conan Doyle, that the fact that he was a Parsi and that he was brown-skinned in a part of Staffordshire. Is there anyone here from Staffordshire? At that time, a very backward part of England. That he and his brother and sister and father were the only brown-skinned people in the whole area for a long while. It was clear. Also, reading some of the anonymous letters, which were part of the case, that racial prejudice was a key factor. But his argument would be, I grew up in a village. My father was the vicar of the Church of England. People went to his church. I went to school. I was well taught. I trained to become a solicitor. I succeeded. People encouraged me. I got on. I wrote a book. They didn't reject it because I was a Parsi. Why should I then, unless you give me specific evidence, decide that this is a case in which my race is an aspect? And I thought that this was much more interesting. I mean, the idea of the victim who doesn't understand why he or she is a victim is for a novelist much more interesting than the victim who understands exactly why he or she is a victim.
The book came out, I think, in 2005. That was after 9/11. It was, I think, after the bombings in London. And there you had this same element again. All of a sudden, people looking strange,
became an issue again, you thought, oh, are they terrorists or what are they? Do you think this sort of came into the book or not?
I would like to be able to say yes, but the honest answer is no, not at all. I mean, it did, as you say, come out. It didn't come out either before or after the 7th of July bombings in London. Its publication day was the 7th of July. And so apart from having all the usual resentments against the bombers, they also had my publication party cancelled, which I think was an outrageous interference with civil liberties. No, look, you start a book starts a long way back. Usually with my books, there's a very distant beginning point, which often you sort of forget until you get to the real beginning point. So about 10 or more years ago, I wanted to try to write something about the sort of disregarded, forgotten, unrecorded black population of London in the 18th or 19th century. I couldn't get any more exact than that. I did various amounts of research. I didn't get anywhere with it. I abandoned it. I forgot about it. I then came across this Adelgee case, and then the machine started working. It wasn't till I was at least halfway through the book that I remembered that I'd had this initial interest from 5 years previously. So what happens is once you get it, once you embark on a book, it has its own logic and its own necessity, and that's what you follow. And I didn't think about September the 11th, though when I went to America, I got some questions about it. And, you know, it's hard to say. Part of you wants to say yes, actually. I think that was feeding into what I was writing, you know, at a certain level. Not at a conscious level, but, you know, these things, they feed in, don't you? But I couldn't honestly say that, you know. The broader answer is that that people of different appearance, race, colour, creed, are looked at differently and maltreated accordingly in different ways in different civilizations, and it has ever been thus, and therefore it was pure, you know, what happened in London after the 7/7 bombings, when you looked at people in the underground in a slightly different way, and that is something, you know, that is akin to how people looked at George 100 years previously. But I would be stretching truth to say that I was trying to make a parallel with the current historical situation.
Another thing which I found striking in the book is that there is a lot of sex in the way, in the sense of sex is absent. For example,
this is a Swiss paradox.
No, it's Lacanian. No, because there's this thing, for example.
Are you married?
Yes.
My condolences to your wife.
No, but there's this bit about Arthur's first wife who contracts TB. Yes. And then the doctor tells him, well, she will be living for another 3 months or so, and that will be it. So, no sex. And then she actually lives for another 13 years. And during that time, he falls in love with another woman, but because he's so chivalrous, he would never do anything about this. So, there's...
And George doesn't have sex either in the book.
And his father, after a certain time, doesn't either. So, it is very conspicuous by its absence. That's what I meant. You know, as in the famous Sherlock Holmes quotation about the dog in the night time.
Yes. I think you should see me privately afterwards. But in a way, it was a relief to write a book in which there wasn't any sex. Not that I mind writing about sex. I enjoy writing about sex. There is one moment of erotic climax, though probably not what you in Switzerland call sex. There's a trousers scene at one point. I won't say anything more in case there are small children in the audience. Well, you know, I think people did often go through their lives not having sex in the old days, and perhaps people still do. Actually, I don't think there's... Is there much sex in the lemon table? Oh, there probably is, yes. Yes, yes there is, isn't there?
Actually, there is, yes. Yes.
Perhaps there's a lot of sex in the lemon table. You obviously have some monitors who are reading my books.